Welcome, everyone. It's nice to see you all. Starting this series on suffering and its cause. My intention for much of this year is to go to the basics of Buddhism, ground ourselves very thoroughly in the fundamentals, but to approach these fundamentals from an urban point of view. What we begin to realize in the course of practice is that certain qualities of Buddhism come forward when our lives are more actively involved, and certain aspects of Buddhism come forward when we have a retreat mentality and when we harbor ourselves away for prolonged periods of time on retreat. And where I sit and what I'm interested in is really making this journey of depth and understanding available and accessible to those of you who have the sincerity and intention to use your life, your urban life, towards spiritual growth. And I delight in the possibility of making that happen. But if we don't have the fundamentals down, then the whole thing goes askew. And I don't know that we have the fundamentals down, because like any sporting team, the practicing of those fundamentals over and over and over again allow a kind of relaxed integration when the need comes up, when the event arises for those fundamentals to be used. And from people's questions and from the comments and from the interviews, it seems to me that we need some review and practice on some of this. If you think this is Buddha light, I suggest you look again. because I continue to grow in relationship to these practices every time I approach them, every time I bring them into consciousness. So move with me in this series as we go through the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and we look at, we do countless talks on just one of the topics, like wise speech or livelihood. We could have three or four talks on one of those to move into depth and the subtlety and intricacies of what these things really mean in terms of our life. But we have to start off with the very basic truth, the very fundamental one, the one that hits you in the face when you open the textbooks of Buddhism, and that is the first noble truth, the noble truth that we have anguish, conflict, suffering in our life. Now, let me say that is, the Buddha never said that life is suffering, although he's misquoted endlessly to that reference. But he says you have to pay attention to the suffering. He was trying to get us to acknowledge that it exists in our life, which is hard enough, because we would rather not acknowledge it. We'd rather just pass it by and move on to the better things that we think our life is about. And there's an inherent tension in when somebody draws our attention to conflict and disappointment and anguish and dissatisfaction. There's an inherent inward conflict that most of us have because we don't want to have to go there. It's like finally sitting down and having that long, delayed conversation with your spouse about all the things that you've held in resentment over time. And that's why resentment builds up, is because we'd rather not have that conversation at all. And yet finally at some point, you know, enough is enough. You can't keep living together holding and maintaining this pattern of resentment. You've got to have the conversation that acknowledges that resentment exists. So when we sit down here, we have to really acknowledge together that this pain in our life is true for us. And that it's not only true, but it forms the principle, the spiritual orientation of not only Buddhism, but of any truly meaningful revelations in our spiritual growth. Why is it so difficult? It's because we're oriented to avoid it. We're oriented to dismissing it. And suddenly, we find ourselves despairing because life isn't as fulfilling as we had thought it would be by scurrying around the difficult issues and finding our way to the pleasant ones. So we have to have this basic tenet down in Buddhism that what we have to do is train our minds to move toward the difficult, not away. Because within the knot of that difficulty lies our spiritual fix. And we will see in the course of our practicing just how sincere and aligned we are to that principle. Quite likely, you've already seen that in yourself. When I hear someone staying endlessly with their attention at the breath, and I'm unable to crowbar them off of it, I know something's going on there that is not in accordance with that principle, with that founding principle, with that truth. Because wherever we engage in a prolonged period of time, certainly at the breath, encouraging those subtle, sublime states of mind, and the comfort and ease that those states of mind nurture in us, and that sense of almost being soothed by our meditation, I want to tap the person on the shoulder and tell them to look to their right and left and see if it's as comfortable behind them as it is with their breath. This is not a breath meditation. This is a meditation to call us out to the difficult, to examine what's going on there, to see and understand and develop a right orientation to that. Nothing happens transfixed upon anything for very long. We have to keep shaking ourselves up, awakening ourselves to what we really need to go, which is the last place that most of us want to go. What we're doing here is finding true fulfillment, not in scurrying around the difficult, but in a renewed understanding within the difficult. And so this principle is so basic to making this meditation work for us as an urban dweller or as a retreatant, that I can't overemphasize it. And believe me, you will be able to find areas after prolonged practice in yourself that hold in abeyance any difficulty at all, where the hindrances you no longer have to access the hindrances. Why? You never have to be restless, sleepy, doubts held in abeyance. And many people just love that place. In fact, generate the effort to get themselves there in order then to have what they call a good retreat. Well, one of the fortunate benefits of being an urban dweller is that you don't quite likely have that power of mind to quiet those hindrances. And may I say, blessed be that fact. Because you have to deal with your restlessness. You have to deal with your anguish on an ongoing basis, on an ongoing relationship, which is what the heart of this whole system is about. Because, you see, what happens is that we are in the process of making the unconscious conscious. The mind left without attention, left without awareness, does not in any way want to make the pain of its life conscious. And its knee-jerk response, its habitual response to pain, is to bypass it, move on to other things. But when we become conscious of the fact that pain exists. When we have the light of our attention being shined upon that area of ourselves that is in a knot within, is in tension, then that willingness to make that conscious, the very definition of the knot is the unconscious habitual response called reactivity. That's what the knot of our pain is. So there's no way to get around it or through it without making that knot conscious, without bringing the light of our attention and awareness into it. And some of us have developed such long enduring patterns and images around those difficulties that we just don't want to have to give up not only the painful moment display, but the image that's based on the nurturance of that over time. It means too much about me to see my loneliness and make it conscious. I'd rather just act it out. Or my depression, or my whatever, fill in the blank. You see, this noble truth, what happens at that point of conflict? In order to have conflict, and I'm using these different words for the word suffering, which we'll go into in just a minute, but let's call that moment of suffering conflict. In order to have conflict, you need a rub. In order to have a rub, you need two things. And the reason that you have a rub is that you have two things. The basis of the truth of Buddhism is that there's only one thing. So we are making, by our reactivity, the two-ness. And the rub comes through that manufacturing. And so we have to reinvest our attention back to where that rub is occurring, making the two, like an alchemist, back into the one. That's how the practice unfolds. That's the point of the Buddha saying, First Noble Truth, there is dissatisfaction, anguish, conflict. Pay attention. So now I thought I wanted to just talk a little bit more traditionally, which is not my bent, but never mind. I will do the best I can. And I want to talk about it in terms of the traditional way that it's spoken about, because in Buddhism, the word dissatisfaction is, in Pali, dukkha. D-U-K-K-H-A. And it means, basically, that life, when looked at, when lived for any prolonged period of time, there is going to be conflict that arises out of it, basically. And these scriptural references talk about three different types of dukkha. The first one is dukkha. Sometimes I think their vocabulary was limited. So what is this dukkha? Dukkha is ordinary pain, ordinary aging, sickness, ordinary mental suffering. I, not too long ago, took a week-long course on the after-death experience in the Tibetan tradition. After someone dies, they go into different bardo states, and they talk about the dissolution of the body and what happens at the time of death, and they have this thing all mapped out. So I thought it would be interesting, having had the background in hospice care, so I took this week-long course, and it was much more than I wanted to know. and they start really talking about how, you know, the earth element, they talk about the four elements of the body. The four elements are the characteristic of any form or any manifestation, which have the manifestation of the earth element, which is the hardness of things, and then fire element, which is the temperature element, and then the water element, which is fluidity, and then air element, which is space. And he talked about how one dissolved into the another and how the phlegm and the pus and all that. And I thought I was equipped to handle these somewhat grotesque. There it was. That's the body in front of us. That was how they saw the dissolution of the elements at the time of death and then the journey of the consciousness from there on. So this sense of dukkha-dukkha has to do with the movement and difficulty and the imbalance that occurs within these elements. And as we age, we certainly feel those imbalances. It also has to do with the pain of just having a mind. In that last series that we talked about in terms of mental distortions, we spoke about how, you know, moment after moment, we may be in completely different mind states, each mind state contradicting the one before it in terms of its assumptions and its posture, personal posture to the world. But we never question the state we're in. We just assume that that one's true and the next one's true and the next one's true, even though there are contradictory statements all along the way. And to have this mind, this constant barrage of states of mind throughout the day, which define how we're going to interact and relate to others and relate to our own lives and how what we think about ourselves, on and on and on we go. And if you have noticed, it just doesn't end with sleep. We dream ourselves into the next illusory relationship. And we get kind of pinned in here with all of this pain to at some point as we mature, there can be a growing despair that we feel. And just ever trying to find or have a solution to make this life work. It just doesn't seem to work very well, despite the commercials, despite the advertisements, despite the Hollywood set. Personally, it just doesn't seem to work very well when we live at the expense of all of this ongoing dukkha-dukkha. And we go on vacation, and we take the mind with us. We don't get out of a thing. In fact, I remember as a monk in Asia, I thought, okay, well now, you know, I've got the perfect setting to just not have any difficulty at all with my mind. And it's interesting what leisure, when you have a lot of leisure time, you suddenly develop all kinds of bumps on your body that you take to be cancer, and I had so many ailments, none of which were ever treated, and I'm alive today, so. And this being, also just seeing the conditioned state of people who don't live as affluently as we do in different parts of the country, when you come across, if for those of you who have been in India, you know that the whole display of life is right there in front of your eyes, people dying, crippled, lame, starving to death, just the brutality of life in its rawest form. I came back from that, I remember, having been deeply affected by what I saw, and I decided that I was going to fast one day a week. And so I did, and one of the teachers asked me why I was fasting, and I said, you know, when you have seen the depth of the pain of the world, and you come back to this affluent West, which hides that pain, covers it over, really. The fasting was a way for me to remember the depth of the despair, the depth of the pain that I had noticed overseas. You see, we just have to know the tricks of the game. And the market economy must sell you a life that has its pinnacle through the pursuit of pleasure. And therefore it must whisk away any remnants of that not working. And so we are a society of mass in which we deny massively the truth of life and the pain that life offers. And we have learned to do that through a variety of defenses that I will talk about coming up here. But just to get a sense of the conditions that we live with here, which takes us to the second kind of dukkha called viparinama dukkha, whatever that means. It is translated as the changing quality of life, the changing states of mind. You know, when we rest upon something, there's an inevitable fall that we all take in that resting, in that fixation. And viparinama dukkha means that circumstances cannot be relied upon. Conditions are unreliable. And how easily we forget that. Time and time again, we expect the person we just met, we expect our animals, our spouses, our life to be a continuation of the same thing. And in fact, this is another cultural imperative to deny that change, changing quality. But you can't do it. You see, to understand that if the sense of I can get conditions to last, then the sense of I can last as well. And since the sense of I is a conditioned phenomena, it tries forever in trying to get everything around it stabilized, so it will have some sense of stability in itself. Always, because no conditions last, including the sense of I, is that ever the final result. And so the constant pulling out of the rug from where we stand, moment after moment, is this viparinama dukkha. Finally, the last form or expression of dukkha is what's called sanskara dukkha. It's actually my favorite, my favorite form of suffering. because it's existential suffering. And I think that, you know, even when we have it all together and we've got everything completely perfect in temperature, in degree, in gradient, in satisfaction, everything, you see, still there's this sense in us that we're outside of it, not abiding within it, you see. So there's this nagging touch of the shoulder that we are visitors to life, not having a life experience. And because it's true, when we have arrested our existence on the reflective gaze to life, outside looking in, which is what thought does. Thought is not accompanying the action of life. It's what happens in the reflection of that action. So therefore, there has to be a gap of time between the action and the reflection. And that creates within us the sense of me looking at life rather than abiding within it. And there's a... At first, it's just status quo. Everybody seems to be in the same fix, but then you start looking at it and you start having movements out of that, perhaps in the meditation, and you start realizing that this is a form of a view that I'm holding about life, an assumption that I have about life that is maintained moment after moment. I keep assuming the posture outside of it. And when we begin to understand that this rub is entirely self-induced, and that the view we hold is one in which we create that kind of backward glance view so that we'll have some security within the chaotic mess of existence, then we begin to see that we have one of two choices. We can maintain that fix or we can join the chaos. as fearful as that might be, there is no other recourse. In fact, when we join it, it's not chaotic at all. It's only chaotic from the sense of memory, from the sense of that reflection. And that's what we try to do. Is all the control that we have in our life is an extension that we keep trying to assert from the reflective glance over on top of life. That's what we try to do. We try to keep influencing it so that we can shake out the chaos and have it conform to what the reflective thoughts about a true and good life can be. We take the point of all that is that we have a stake in keeping it going. We have a stake in keeping our pain going. That when we see the pain, we really understand that the pain is self-induced. And then when it becomes an unconscious thing, we get annoyed because we're in pain, and we lose the sense that we're doing it to ourselves. Pain, not physical pain. You have a pain in the knee, and then you have the mental anguish associated with the pain in the knee. I'm not talking about the pain in the knee as being self-induced. That's not. Having an aging body is going to provide pain. But the mental anguish associated with it. Pain is important. It tells you that something's wrong physically. And then what we have done is we have configured our intellect in such a way is that it has pain on top of that pain. That's the pain that is self-induced. That's the pain that is maintained by and for our own protection. Why do I say that? Because we think we need to have that kind of reflection, that sort of back space from life, in order to maintain our sense of continuity and security for life. And when we pull back, we're going to be in pain. And then we're going to get tired of the pain of pulling back. So the whole thing starts collapsing. At this point, if we are unconscious, we start praying to God and creating a heaven as a realm in which we can get out of the pain that we feel like we're dragging with us through our entire life. God is created from our pain. We look at God as a safe haven against the pain of our existence. And so most of our prayer is self-involved. Please take this burden off my shoulders. Completely wrong association and attitude to pain, to suffering, to anguish. It's self-induced. I don't care who you pray to. If you hold the strings, if you hold the gun to your head, there's no one that can take that gun out of your hand. Pray all you want. We have to see this thing for ourselves to understand that the problem of our existence is imposed by no one. And to look at that, and it can't be avoided, it can't be circumvented. And in fact, pain has a place to play upon the evolution of our spiritual lives. When there is sufficient pain and a sufficient annoyance, suddenly we, the consciousness, awareness, gets fed up with it. And then we're either to the point of which we say that life is not worth living if I have to live it like this, or we are ready then for real change. To really look, to be, make the pain conscious. But we have to be driven to that point. And most of us in this room, if I might say, are not completely mature enough to own that all of our pain is self-inflicted. We still have this immediate conditioned response to look outward for sources of our pain. To blame it on our spouse, to blame it on our boss, to blame it on our neighbor, to blame it on the person next to us, to blame it on the conditions of the weather, to blame it, to blame it, to blame it. It's so hard to get that principle down, yet so essential if you're going to ripen sufficiently. So that the maturity of really addressing pain completely, totally, without any delay, no more delay now. Let me look at this. Let me look at what I'm holding. If we don't get this principle down, if we don't understand this principle, nothing in Buddhism works. Why do you think it's the first noble truth? But we play out our strategies to try to outfox it. We say to yourself, so what? There's suffering. What does that have to do with me? Well, check yourself out. Or we try to outwit it. We try to... One of the reasons that money holds such importance to us is that we think we can buy our way out of it. The more money you have, the more... you can secure a life free of that. We try all kinds of ways to find happiness around it. You can't. How is that possible, you see? When there's any strategy to seek its opposite, as the poem I was reading by Lao Tzu, then the irritation of that seeking follows us in more and more subtle ways. As I mentioned in another talk, if you are a wine connoisseur and you only love a particular year and vintage of grape in southern France, then every other vintage is going to be not quite right. But if you don't have any particular focus on the specialty of wine, almost anything within reason works fine. No problem, no suffering. The more we define what we call the perfect grape, the more suffering closes in around that perfection. And so all opposites, and we talked about last year around this time, we were talking about the shadow forming, the shadow formation. And so there's a series of talks for those who have missed it. If you want to get that attribute, that characteristic of pain and how pain follows us by our very defining of it. So first we need to stabilize ourselves and recognize that we are in trouble and that we are accountable for it. Now, what does that mean? When circumstances arise and anger arises in me, that what I'm saying is that we're not looking outward to blame the anger upon. The anger is not caused by somebody else. It's arising in you, in me, and has to be accounted for as this organism having anger. Not you making me angry. No one produces emotions in another. We are all responsible for the emotions that arise within us and how we interpret the situation and circumstances of a particular situation. An emotion arises in accordance to that interpretation. It doesn't mean then that you take blame for everything. If you can't blame outwardly, then we point and try to blame inwardly. This is not about self-blame either. This is about conditions arising, and we have full responsibility for what it is that's going on inside. It's not that I'm a terrible person for having anger, or that I'm an angry person, or the person is out of it. That's not necessary to even bring the person in. Just look at the situation and be willing to hold it. Being willing to be accountable for what is actually occurring, rather than to point fingers at events for that occurrence. I say that, and I probably have said it 1,000 times. How many of us really get it? Really understand it? Have sharpened our focus sufficiently so that we really see, oh, I get it. It takes that kind of dramatic insight for you never again to blame in either direction, inwardly or outwardly. Full stop. The reason we don't is because the emotion has implications about my image. That's why I can't maintain this emotion. That's why I can't hold it in myself, because it implies something other than what I want my image to be. And when we are in that kind of conflict over our internal world, we will project that internal world externally to say that you created the problem, not me. It's not my fault. Because the image above all else, maintaining that image above all else. So the first real step of maturity, and may I go through a few of these steps now in the time remaining, one is, you know what? You accept responsibility. Full stop. That's it. Anger, period. Doesn't mean you don't have communication with the people who you have problems with in your life, or that you're becoming a meshed boundary. It's not that. You just take full responsibility for your inward life. That's the first step in this eightfold path. That's the first step in the maturation of this first noble truth. The second is that we start understanding that that suffering, that anguish, comes from my mind and my relationship I'm having with things. It's not inherent in reality. It's my reflective relationship. It's what I'm saying in regards to what is occurring, not what is occurring. That's where pain, we're saying that this shouldn't be happening, basically. That's where the problem comes in. So that's the second step to maturation in this first noble truth. The third is, I'm fed up living like this. There has to be a threshold in which we are so tired of what we're doing to ourselves and the constant need to blame that doing on others that it all implodes and we say, that's it. I'm sick and tired of this. The fourth step is that we understand that we can't escape the problem by looking for happiness outside of it, by circumventing the problem. That we have to go into the problem. We have to abide in pain. Sounds like a happy time, doesn't it? See, that's the thing. We didn't get into it for that. We didn't get into meditation for this. This is not what I wanted. I want it out of my suffering. In fact, we think that way. Suffering is what we're the beginning, what we're trying to get out of. The spiritual search is the search to end suffering. And what we seek are the causes. Spiritual seeking is the causes of that suffering. So yes, eventually we will get out of that anguish, but we can only get out of it by going into it, not by reacting or avoiding it. See, that's such a key point. And again, even though I've said it probably another 1,000 times, How many of us really understand that point? You see, we think, oh, first noble truth, no problem. Yeah, I know, it's my mind. Now let's move on. The fifth maturation is once we get a sense that it's on us, we can't escape it, we have to acknowledge it and enter it, is that there's a difference between the experience and the secondary reaction to the experience, the relationship to the experience. I'm beginning to see two things, physical pain and my fear of physical pain. My fear of what that physical pain may become. And to know that there are two things going on here is the next very important unfolding of that maturity. And then there's this great turnaround, which I call it. Where we're willing to face that pain and not look away. Where we're beginning to see that true fulfillment comes from the non-movement of the unsatisfactory. And if I bring any sense of movement, which is fear or reaction, to that suffering, to that experience, that unpleasant experience, the result will be more subtle suffering. And because now I'm on top of the fact that I'm causing this for myself mentally through my relationship, I understand that the relationship has to be one of stillness rather than movement. Now we're really maturing. And when those brief moments when there is no movement in regard to that unsatisfactory, unpleasant event, lo and behold, we find that there is no anguish. And now we're beginning to understand how this thing opens up. So that unless I go into it and understand all of the different steps that I've just recounted, there's bound to be movement at every level. And that what I'm doing is trying to endure through this pain so that I'll have a more pleasant experience after it. And I can't do that with my meditation. I have to be mature enough to understand that this has to be dealt with. No more running from conflict is what I'm saying. Those of you, and there are probably many of us in this room, whose lives have been conditioned to avoid conflict, in every way, there's no room for that anymore. So we need to sober up to this fact. Now you can see why an urban orientation can bring forth exponentially the speed of our growth if we use it in accordance with the principles. Or it can encourage a delightful, imaginative flight and escape route from everything, which is, we're sort of in between those two. But when you get serious, you know where to go. And then there's a question that comes in this great turnaround. Who suffers? What is causing this suffering? You see, all we've done so far is that we've steadied ourselves with the First Noble Truth. We have yet to learn what it is the ingredients, the decoding of that relationship is so that I can put down the burden entirely. But the First Noble Truth gets our attention and sobers us. No longer, we're immediately sober. No longer willing to play our lives away, to fret them away. to pray to God for our salvation. We're the ones that are turning the thumbscrew and praying God for some alleviation of the pain. So the sobering ourselves, the willingness to look, to make the unconscious conscious, because pain, by its very nature, is unconscious. Then we know what the first noble truth is about. Then we can move lightningly quick to the cause of that suffering. And may we all see that. Can we sit for a minute or two? So I often think, as we sit here, I often think that at some point the Buddha must have just sobered up, where he accepted full responsibility for his life. And then, when that is acknowledged, the play of creativity, the questioning, moves out beyond any boundary. Who is it that suffers? What is it that suffers? What is suffering? What causes this? What's the chemistry of this event? What if I'm taking responsibility, what am I doing? Why aren't I seeing this? What's going on here? The critical issue is asking those questions so that it invites the awareness to make the unconscious conscious.